I think we should let go of the idea that we need to have a single unifying theory of the brain. I don't think we do. I think we're going to have multiple different accounts that will kind of fit together like a patchwork quilt. Possibly a lot of the more sophisticated cognitive processes that we now use are really piggybacking on neural machinery that originally evolved for movement. We definitely want machines to make lapses. And the reason is,
this is Brain Inspired.
Hello, expert decision makers. This is Paul Middlebrooks. Welcome to the show. Today, I have Anne Churchland on the show, whom you just heard. Anne runs her lab at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, where she studies decision-making behavior and the neural circuits underlying that behavior. To do this, she experiments with rodents, recording and or manipulating various parts of their brains while they do tasks, often tasks that integrate visual and auditory perception. And she creates models to better understand how the neural populations implement those decisions. Decision-making has been a hot topic in neuroscience for, I would say, about a quarter of a century now. And as Anne has written about, it's going strong and undergoing lots of exciting new developments as our technologies and theories advance. You may recognize Anne's surname, Churchland. So in case you are wondering or didn't already know, yes, she is the daughter of the neuroscience/philosophy famous parents, Paul and Patricia Churchland. Some of what we cover today includes how Anne defines decision, how decisions are studied in brains, some of the benefits of studying in rodents what we often consider higher cognitive functions, and switched from studying decisions in non-human primates or monkeys to studying it in rodents many years ago now. We talk about how lapses in decision-making may serve as an ingrained way to ensure an animal or you explores alternative options in an uncertain environment, how brain activity during decisions is kind of dominated by movement-related activity, some of which relates to the task at hand, but some of which doesn't. That would be fidgets and twitches and so forth. We talk about why we might want machines to have lapses in their decision-making, but probably not those fidgets and twitches. If you're going to the Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference, as you should be, you can see her talk about this kind of stuff during her keynote address there. Among other things, we also touch on a resource that she created to help people invite more women speakers to speak at conferences, and you can find that at annslist.net. And of course, that will be linked in the show notes, as will the other relevant information at braininspired.co/podcast/39. Thank you to my Patreon supporters out there. I hope you guys continue to find this show useful and inspiring. If you, kind sir or madam, find this show valuable and want to contribute and get access to things as I create them moving forward, you can support the show for about what it costs to park for an hour at a parking meter during each episode. Go to braininspired.co and click the red Patreon button there. As always, if you have questions or suggestions for future guests or topics, send me an email to paul@braininspired.co, or you can reach out on Twitter. I'm @PGMID. I do have a full slate of guests line up over the next few months here that I am excited to bring to you, just as I am excited to now bring you Anne Churchland. Anne, thanks for joining me on the show, and welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here chatting with you today.
So when I was young and my dad got a well enough paying job, we got a pool and put a hot tub in, and it was like an event. We would go out, we'd get in the hot tub, we'd get the extension cord and pull out our tiny tube television that had rabbit ear antennae. And we'd sit around and we'd talk, you know, but we'd like watch Monday Night Football, you know, and sometimes Murder, She Wrote, the television program, and like Columbo. And we'd say things like, oh, it's hot in here, you know, and then my brother and I would get out and we'd jump in the pool and say, we'd say, oh, it's cold. Now, your mom says that you guys would have do a similar sort of thing, but you'd have long discussions in your hot tub about morality and whether it should be studied and things of that nature. Do you remember these hot tub discussions?
I do remember them. Yes. And you're quite correct. We also had a hot tub and a pool, and we did spend a lot of time kind of hanging out in the hot tub chatting. And it was kind of a fun venue because actually in a lot of ways, my parents were pretty strict about a lot of things. But when it came to having an intellectual discussion, they were much more open and they really encouraged me and also my brother to kind of explore any kind of idea and to disagree with them, even sometimes very strongly. And so it was really, I think, kind of a great training ground to learn about ways that are constructive to discuss ideas. And also just to kind of start to understand their excitement about a lot of questions that have continued on to be really important in neuroscience.
Man, so we have at least hot tubs in common, but not the content of discussion. So, well, very good. So you come really, I guess, from the monkey neurophysiology decision-making world, and you moved to the rodent decision-making world, like your colleague, Tony Zader, whom I've had on the show here, and you're really helping that field to grow and flourish these days. And in rodents, you do use neurophysiology to record neural activity while rats perform tasks, just like monkeys, but you also take advantage of more modern techniques that are not used with non-human primates, monkeys these days. So what do you get to do with rodents that you couldn't do in the monkey world, and what advantages does that confer?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have both model systems in the field because, as you say, I think they offer really different advantages. I think with the rodent, we have many tools available. Just to give you a couple of examples of the most powerful techniques, it's a lot easier in rodents to use transgenic tools to look at the activity, that is the neural responses of not all of the cells, but just certain cells within the brain. Hmm. And sometimes you want to see what every neuron in the brain is doing. So for that kind of experiment, it's useful. You can look at a primate brain or even a human brain. But sometimes you want to look at the neurons in a more specific way. For instance, you might only care about the neurons that are in the cortex that are projecting to the striatum. That's a deeper part of the brain that seems to be involved in reward and value assessment. And using mice, we have different kinds of genetic tools that we can use to look at just those neurons and look in a very specific way about what they're doing. Hmm. Another advantage is that the mouse is pretty small and has a very flat brain, doesn't have the kinds of bumps and grooves that our human brains have.
Right.
And also
right.
The skull is really thin. So we are in some work that I'm going to talk about at the conference, we're able to see we're able to measure the responses of neurons through the intact skull of the mouse. And that is a big win. It means that we can look at lots and lots of animals because it's pretty easy to do. It's non-invasive. And it's given us a really different picture of how neurons respond during different kinds of behaviors.
You know, when I started out, I don't know if this is still the case, but I don't know how many times I heard that recording neurons in non-human primates was the gold standard. Still, you know, even when I was after I got my PhD, it still was considered the gold standard to record single neurons or populations of neurons in monkeys while they're performing these higher cognitive tasks, let's say. So I'm wondering, I don't know if that still is the gold standard. I'm sure it's shifting, but I'm wondering how the non-human primate research world has sort of reacted to this recent resurgence that you're bringing forth with rodent neurophysiology and cognitive decision-making studies.
Well, I think the more progressive people in the primate field really appreciate that the two model systems are really offering different things.
Yeah.
And that by working together, we're in a much better position than we ever were before when people were largely focused on non-human primates. We're in a much better position to really tackle the big problems that have been a bugaboo in the field for a long time. And if the mice people and the primate people work together, for instance, somebody working in a mouse could start to hone in on which circuits are the really relevant ones, perhaps using genetic tools, taking advantage of the fact that it's very high throughput, and then collaborate with someone who works with primates first of all, to see if those observations generalize to a different animal, and also to extend those observations towards behaviors that might be a little more primate specific. For instance, a particular way of using the hand that's different in primates, not human and non-human primates compared to rodents, for example. So I think there's a good crew of people out there that are really open to that kind of team effort to collectively understand how the brain works by leveraging multiple animals.
And then there are the curmudgeons.
Well, I think all of us have to kind of resist the temptation to be kind of lazy or sloppy in our thinking about why we do the things the way we do. And I think in a scientific context, that is. And I think sometimes when one is trained in a particular approach, whether it's a particular model system in this case, or, you know, could be a different way, a particular way of measuring neural activity and so on, we can just sort of start to think, well, that's the best. And someone will say, well, what about this other method? And someone who's kind of using sloppy thinking will just say, oh, well, that's obviously silly. You know, mice are obviously blind, you know. And I think whenever we're making a decision about whether to shift our own scientific direction or whether we're evaluating somebody else's work, we have to really think deeply about what that approach is offering us. And is it the right approach to tackle the question at hand? And none of these approaches are perfect, right? We all want to understand humans running around in a natural environment. We are all approximating that in a laboratory setting in a way that's quite different. And so we all need to be thinking about the trade-offs and try to avoid that kind of lazy or sloppy thinking where, well, my way is the best because I know it's the best. We have to hold ourselves to a higher standard.
You mentioned the symbiotic nature that is possible with two model systems like rodents and non-human primates. But do you see or know where there's a bright line in the level of cognitive process that can be studied in mice or rats, that beyond which we can't study them in mice and rats, that we have to move on to something like humans or monkeys?
I think yes and no. I should start off by saying that it's happened many times that there has been a kind of behavior that people have said, well, you know, this is it. Yeah. This can only be studied in monkey. And I know because it's really hard and difficult, and it took me a long time to train the non-human primate. And I also know because I tried it for 2 weeks in a mouse and it didn't work. So obviously mice are dumb. And then, you know, somebody else tries it and they read books on dog training and dolphin training and they have a bunch of new ideas. And then lo and behold, it turns out to be feasible. And I think the real lesson here is that actually a lot of us are operating in a regime where we're taking advantage of computations that many, many animals have that they had to have to exist in the natural world. Right. When you're an animal that is around today, you've evolved for many, 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 many years, and you know how to forage in environments to find food. You know how to exploit environments in new ways when food and water start to run low. You know how to interact with other creatures to find out who in your conspecific is a friend and who is a foe, who is predator, who is prey. The act of navigating through an ordinary world requires an incredibly sophisticated brain. And even though our laboratory versions of the tasks seem difficult and are certainly sometimes very difficult to communicate to the animals, right? We have to tell them what we want them to do. The kinds of computations that they're relying on are ones probably that many, many animals use in very diverse environments.
Well, those a lot of the computations that you study have to do with decision making. And when the word decision is used commonly, it often isn't clear, you know, whether someone is talking about a decision in their thoughts, you know, just I'm going to go to the store later, or a decision in action, like actually getting in the car and going to the store or something. So what is a decision with respect to the kind of decision making that you study?
Yeah, so we think of a decision as being an instance where a subject is selecting between one or more possible alternatives. And I think in almost every case, almost every decision does lead to action. Okay, so we'll start simple, right? You're at the stoplight, you're deciding to stay. That would mean to put your foot on the brake. To go would mean to put your foot on the gas. So there's a natural action for each of those. Mm-hmm. Some of those, you're deciding on something that will have an action. Maybe you haven't specified it yet, right? You've decided, I want to go to dinner at, you know, Starbucks tonight, and I'm going to decide later whether I will walk there or ride my bike.
Starbucks?
Sure, with Starbucks. Yeah. They have some nice sandwiches, actually.
Okay.
Right. So if I were really pressed, I think there's a very small class of decisions that don't lead to action at all. And the only ones I've been able to come up with are decisions that involve a change in belief. right? Mm. So when I was a really little kid, I believed in the tooth fairy. But then one day I decided, well, you know, probably there isn't a tooth fairy. There were no actions that were a consequence of that because I still put the tooth under my pillow and I still got the quarter. So there was actually no action outcome, even though I had a belief that changed within my mind. So I think there are some decisions that don't lead naturally to actions, but many, many decisions do. So I think in terms of what's a good strategy in the laboratory for understanding them, I think starting with decisions that lead to action is a good way to go.
Why do you, so earlier you were talking about how we used to, and we still do, think of cognitive processes of sort of higher order things, and then we discover that ants can do them, for instance, you know, and other plenty of animals have cognitive abilities that we didn't appreciate before. And decision-making often gets lumped into the higher cognitive function. Why is that? Why do people consider decision-making a higher cognitive function?
I think because decisions can span a range of complexity that includes really very sophisticated ones. So I think we should, if we'll stick to action-based decisions for a moment, I think we should think of all sensory to action behaviors as existing along a continuum where mm-hmm. some of them are so automatic, like the knee-jerk reflex at the doctor, that we probably would all agree, well, that's not really a decision, to ones at the far other extreme, like deciding which car to buy or which career path to choose. And I think at the far end, what makes those decisions interesting is a few things. First of all, I think that they include multiple sources of information that govern what the decision maker eventually decides to do. Right. So with the car, you might look at the car. It's visual features might matter. You might kick the tire. You might look up information, Blue Book, to find out how other people like the car and so on. Those are all very, very different kinds of information. Right. Some of them are sensory. Some of them you kind of infer from reading a book and you have to figure out how to weight those. That is how much each one should influence the decision. And then you have to figure out when to act. And those really complex decisions operate on kind of a flexible time scale, right? You can decide at any moment to buy a car, and when you decide to do it probably depends on how convincing each of those pieces of information are. But to me, what the decisions that I find interesting and where I sort of the kinds of things I want to study are decisions where the animal or human is putting together multiple pieces of information and using all of those collectively to figure out what to do.
Speaking of higher cognitive function and putting together multiple pieces of information, you will be giving a keynote address at the Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference in this coming year in Berlin. And I'm imagining that you'll be talking, you already mentioned, alluded to some of a bit of what you'll be talking about. But part of what you do is study the integration of multiple modalities of sensory information and how they get integrated into making decisions. But so what are some of the possible topics that you'll be talking about at CCN?
Well, I'm at the conference this year. I'm going to talk about some new work, new decision-making work that's coming out of my lab, in which we use a technique where we can look at the responses of neurons all across the dorsal cortex. So it was an experiment that gave us the chance to see how many different parts of the brain were working together during auditory and visual decisions. And having animals make those kinds of multisensory decisions where they're making the same choice but guided by different information allows us to distinguish parts of the brain that are involved in kind of sensory processing and movement preparation from ones that are really involved in the decision. And one of the things that I'll talk about that we found really surprising in this work is that a lot of neural activity, a lot of the responses of neurons that we measured really had to do with movements that the animals were making. And part of this was not a surprise, right? People have known for a long time, if you're studying decisions that lead to action, and you and I have discussed that's kind of a strategic thing to do, then naturally the decision maker will be making an action and there will be consequences in the brain as a result of that action. So part of that we weren't surprised to find. But what was exciting and really caught us by surprise is that in addition to those instructed movements that we taught the animals to make, they made many other movements. They sort of explored this very rich movement landscape that changed over the course of learning and really, really dominated neural activity. So the upshot of this is that even for a cognitive behavior like decision making, even in a well-trained expert, a lot of what's engaging the brain is not cognition, but the movements that accompany it.
Yeah, like I'm shifting my feet, I think I'm picking my fingers a little bit while we talk, things like that.
Well, that's a great point. And one of the reasons that I think such movements are surprising is that for animals and for humans, they come at a big cost, right? So first of all, moving your body all the time is metabolically expensive. And in fact, people who fidget a lot can often be very thin as a result. And in humans, it also comes with a social cost. So you mentioned that you like to move your feet a lot. I hate to tell you this, but people probably find it really annoying.
No, I'm just shifting my, I'm just trying to think of like what I'm doing. I'm not.
Yeah. A lot of people do it. I mean, kids get in a lot of trouble at school for fidgeting, right? It drives the less thoughtful teachers totally up the wall. It comes at a big social cost. And yet these movements persist.
So we'll come back to that research because I want to cover a couple of the recent things that you've been studying. So so that's great. And you have a paper in BioArchive that describes a little bit of the results of what you're talking about. So we'll go in more depth a little bit later on that. What right now is sort of a critical question that intrigues you and drives you?
Yeah, so I think the key questions that excite me at the moment involve kind of thinking bigger. And I mean that thinking big kind of on two spatial scales. So first of all, I'm interested in thinking big in terms of not just what does one part of the brain do to support a cognitive behavior, but how do many, many areas work together to support a cognitive behavior? How many areas are engaged? When are they engaged? What are they doing for the animal? And then along the same lines, when we zoom in and look at what neurons do within a particular area, I'm really excited about thinking about how a whole collection of such neurons, which we call a population, how that population activity is supporting the cognitive computations that are taking place. And part of the reason I think this is an exciting question is that as a field, we've started to really quite suddenly have a much more powerful array of analytic tools to interpret neural activity that's coming from lots of different neurons at the same time. We used to just measure one neuron, and we would do that, you know, every day for a year. Then we'd have a bunch of neurons, we'd average them together, and now we're realizing that there are many different ways to think about that activity, to analyze it, and to understand what it's telling us about the underlying computation.
So you just touched a lot of ground there, but what do you think we need more or better of? Do you think we need even more data coming in? Do you think we need better models, more theory? If you had to choose, what's most lacking?
Well, we have a lot of data.
So
I don't know that we need more data, although I think we do need kind of better data, because I think we as a field, we need to be better in terms of measuring animal behavior in a much more holistic way. So we need to really have either sensors or video that are telling us what the animal's entire body is doing. So that's a kind of data that I think is missing in a lot of studies and will really be critical for interpreting the neural activity. The other thing I think we need is for people who are theoretical neuroscientists and people who are experimentalists to work more closely together. Because although some really, really amazing tools are being developed, they aren't necessarily being fully leveraged by people who would really benefit from them. I think maybe because of a cultural gap of a few sorts that's kind of prevented that from fully happening.
Like you said, we used to record one neuron at a time. And I remember my advisor when I was a graduate student said, if you just one neuron a day, and that's great progress, you know, and by the end of my postdoc, I was recording up to 70 neurons at a time or something. Right. So the data is coming in more and more. And like you said, there are lots of new tools to analyze the data, including population activity within a single trial, because when you're, you know, the classic way, and I even have a paper in review right now that still analyzes the data this way, where we recorded neural activity, we're averaging over many, many trials in various conditions, and then you compare the activity of the neurons across those conditions. So that still happens, but there are these more sophisticated and nuanced analyses like you're talking about, and with those new theoretical frameworks that are being developed to account for the data. And this has been happening for, you know, a handful of years now. But decision-making in the brain has an established history and paradigm with the idea that you accumulate evidence for some option, one of the alternate options, until that evidence reaches some threshold, and then you make the decision and you enact that decision. And there are well-known models and theoretical frameworks like the drift diffusion model that describe that process really well. And you've written about how decision-making neuroscience is undergoing swift changes these days. We're in the midst of a big change. As our technology improves, do you think that decision-making theories will undergo like a paradigm shift, or will it just become further and further refined sort of as is?
Well, I think it's really clear from the behavior that both humans and primates, and also rodents as well, do accumulate evidence in favor of a decision. So I think that kind of framework really is the right way of thinking about it for the behavior. And the fact that it's such a simple framework that can account for really behavior in a lot of diverse circumstances means that it's a really powerful place to start. But I think that acknowledging the importance of that framework for understanding behavior doesn't necessarily tell us how it will be implemented in the brain. Hmm. So one possibility, and the one that you alluded to a moment ago, is there might be a single neuron whose firing rate reflects the amount of accumulated evidence. But it needn't be that way, right? You could also have a bigger group of neurons that responded in a sequence, and it was that sequence that reflected the accumulation of evidence. There are, and people like Kanika Rajan and David Tank have argued that actually a sequential form of evidence accumulation or persistent activity more generally might be more stable and robust and have a number of advantages kind of on theoretical grounds. So I think we should hang on to that model in terms of a conceptual framework of thinking about what subjects actually do. But I think we should be open-minded into the way that it's implemented in the brain. And I think leaving aside recent debates on this issue, which has certainly been a very hotly debated issue, I think everyone would agree that there's no reason to think that in every animal, and even in every system within an animal, that accumulation of evidence would be implemented in the same way. We have evidence of that from other kinds of computations, like divisive normalization, for example, is something that we would call a canonical computation in the sense that it's clearly present in many kinds of neural computations in many kinds of animals, but it isn't always implemented in the same way. Like in the olfactory bulb of the fly work of Rachel Wilson, it's implemented very differently from in the visual cortex of the monkey or of the visual association areas in attention.
Part of what you've written about is with this incoming data, ability to record so much data, and it's so such rich data sets that we need to continue developing new theories to sort of account for the data. In the broader sense, like why do we need to wait until we have new forms of data collection to invent new theories? Why can't we intuit what theories we'll need to invent once we are able to collect this sort of data?
Yeah, well, I think you're describing two different theoretical approaches, both of which I think are good, right? One of them you might call sort of a normative approach, like, okay, well, I've observed the behavior, you know, like accumulation to bound or multisensory integration. What should the brain do in order to optimally perform this computation? And then you could look for a signature of the computation that your theory predicted. So that's a fine way of doing things, and people have done that. Kind of reinforcement learning is sort of an example of a big success story there. We'd expect neurons to respond following unexpected reward, and indeed they do. But there's another approach you could take, right, which is sort of a more statistical approach. You take a bunch of data during some kind of a behavior, and you just say, well, what's in the data? You know, what's there? And I think both of those are actually really important. I think we should let go of the idea that we need to have a single unifying theory of the brain. I don't think we do. I think we're going to have multiple different accounts that will kind of fit together like a patchwork quilt. And it will include very conceptual things like a diffusion to bound model. It will include mathematical things like computations, a definition of computations, things like gain control, memory, and so on. Yeah. And then it will also include kind of data-driven statistical accounts. And I think all of those things can exist and all those things should exist in parallel.
So I can imagine, and I don't know how far away this is, but at some point we're going to be recording all neurons, right? We're going to have some technology, some, you know, whether you call it neural dust or whatever you call it, we're going to be able to record from all neurons all the time. Is that the necessary critical mass that will suffice to understand what's important with respect to mechanisms giving rise to cognition-like decisions? You know, where is that critical mass?
I don't think that's what we're missing. I think it's going to be really important to record from larger and larger populations of neurons, partly because that will enable us to record from lots of neurons in very different parts of the brain to see how they interact. But at a certain point, there's, you know, the brain has 86 billion neurons, it's probably not 86 billion dimensional, right? Like when you record 1,000 neurons, you realize, you know, depending on the on what the animal's doing, that the dimensionality of the neural response is actually much lower than that. So you can account for almost all of the neural activity using some number of dimensions that's much smaller than 1,000.
Yeah.
Sometimes it might be as big as 100 or 200. Often it's quite a bit lower than that. These are probably, we're probably underestimating the dimensionality a little bit because we're mostly exploring behaviors that are fairly simple. But nevertheless, neurons tend to be kind of redundant with each other. Their firing rates tend to go up and down together. They'll all fluctuate up and down together as part of some kind of a neural state change. And so we aren't probably going to need to record 86 billion of them to understand what the brain is doing. But I would like to record more of them. I think we don't quite have enough, but we probably won't need all of them.
1 billion. Let's go 1 billion.
Let's go with 1 billion. Yeah.
Well, there's also, you know, technologies like optogenetics where, you know, which you take advantage of, where you have finer control of stimulating various subtypes of neurons, right? So in a similar vein, you know, what kind of granularity is enough for manipulation in studies like stimulation and ablating neural activity? Because these days, the way, for instance, I recorded and stimulated in frontal eye field, and you stick the electrode down in there and you give it a little shock, and it's and it can evoke an eye movement, right? But that shock is gigantic relative to the little neurons that are in there. It's like hitting it with a baseball bat, sort of. But and now we have this finer kind of control. But again, I can imagine going even smaller, and then we're going to be able to control single receptors, for instance, right? That can control the incoming voltage responses and stuff. So where is that granularity? At what point are we going to think that we're granular enough in that respect?
I think it will depend a lot on the area and the behavior, because I think in parts of the brain where the responses of the neurons are very heterogeneous, like in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex of the primate, for instance, you record one neuron and then a neuron next to it, and they're really quite different. In an area like that, using the kind of stimulation where you're either elevating or suppressing the activity of a whole bunch of neurons together,
yeah,
it's very difficult to interpret because probably you're altering the response of a bunch of neurons that are part of very different circuits. So I think we're starting to get to a really exciting place where we can first target cells based on particular properties. For instance, this is related to what I was saying before. In addition to being able to visualize all of the neurons, say, that are in the cortex projecting to the striatum, you could also stimulate all of those neurons.
Right.
So then you're starting to activate a much more specific population than you would be with either electrical stimulation or with optogenetic stimulation, where you have a non-specific promoter. So you're activating all the neurons together.
Yeah.
So, and people are also starting to be able to use another technique where they first measure the activity of a bunch of neurons during behavior. There's some nice work, I think, coming out of Shaul Druckmann's lab with Carl Svoboda, where they find out which neurons appear to be very closely linked to the behavior, for instance, by looking at how strongly they're weighted in decoders and so on, and then activating those neurons specifically. And we're starting to be able to do that with techniques that allow a laser to move around from one neuron to the next, only hitting the ones that you really think are important. So that allows a stronger test of some of these hypotheses in which neurons contribute rather idiosyncratically to a behavior.
Hey, take a break. Think about how awesome it is that you're learning while you're on your run or on your commute, or how great that experiment you're setting up is going to turn out, or just how great it is to be alive. And we've talked a lot about the neuroscience side of it. How do you think neuroscience, like computational neuroscience and cognitive science and artificial intelligence, can best work together? I know, for instance, that you have a massive International Brain Laboratory collaboration, which we'll talk about later, I hope. But how do you think these different fields can work together best?
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting time for the fields to come together more. I think neuroscience can learn a lot from AI. I think we might want to think about artificial networks as being kind of a new kind of model organism, one that has solved the problem in a way that's optimal in the sense that defined by the person who built the network. And so by looking at how a network solves a problem and what the units look like in that network, we can compare that to what an animal does and then think about why the two might be similar, why they might be different, how their learning trajectories are similar or are different. And I think that can be really, really informative. And I think that effort will really be bolstered by the fact that a lot of the artificial networks have had improvements to them that are making them making the way that they learn more similar to the way that brains learn. For example, you could have an episodic reinforcement learning network that takes advantage of its own previous experience, kind of in the way that you and I, if we were making a decision, would draw on our own previous experience to figure out what to do. And also networks that are able to do meta learning, sort of learning how to learn, because they're trained on different kinds of tasks. And I think people are already starting to make really interesting comparisons across those networks that are trained to do these things and animals that are trained to do the same thing. And there are neural recordings available. Really beautiful paper from Julia Wang and Matt Botvinnik and many other of their colleagues that came out at the end of last year drew a lot of really exciting parallels between the networks and the brain. So I think it's a really exciting time for neuroscience and AI to learn better. And cognitive science as well. I think cognitive science and systems neuroscience are often rather separate. I think the CCN meeting is one of the few venues that really brings those three together. And I think it's really exciting.
Well, you led the canonical computations in, what was the name of the little conference that you led recently? Canonical?
Oh, yeah. What was it called? Canonical Computations in Brains and Machines.
Oh, okay, yeah. Which was very similar in vein, you know?
It was. It was very similar in vein, yeah. We tried to bring in a lot of people from outside academia for that well. We had some people from Google and Facebook and DeepMind, although I guess CCN does as well. And yeah, it was cool. I mean, it was a really exciting conference. It was also amazing to see the community's enthusiasm for the meeting. We had a huge auditorium, and the meeting was on a Saturday. And I remember the people helping us organize the meeting were like, I don't know if anyone's going to come.
Oh, wow.
And then the whole thing sold out in like 36 hours. Hugely popular.
Despite having so many people, you still had to tame Terry Sanofsky and let other people ask questions.
Oh, yes. But that was no problem.
I had Terry on the show. So what's one of the best or most memorable moments that you've had at a conference, attending or presenting?
I think the most memorable moments for me at conferences are something kind of small, actually. For me, what's really exciting is to go to a poster of somebody whose work I generally find interesting, and then to realize going through the poster that they have borrowed an idea that we developed and are using it in a new way.
Cool.
And it's really, really neat to see that. Partly it's always exciting when your ideas start to take hold, but to see someone kind of take that idea and apply it to a totally new system is really, really exciting to see. So for instance, in a paper that we had come out a few years ago, we developed a test to look at how related neurons were to each other in terms of their response properties and so on. And we developed this for using in a rat multisensory task in a part of the brain that's pretty far back called the posterior parietal cortex. And it was really exciting to see another group, this was Ben Hayden's group, take that approach and bring it to totally different animal, to non-human primate, and apply it to neurons in the frontal cortex. And also to kind of build on it, they added a few tweaks that made it actually even better than the original tool that we developed, and then to use it to discover something about a very different system. So for me, that's really exciting. I really love the idea that there can be techniques that are relevant to multiple different model systems and multiple different scientific questions. And to see our own ideas kind of borrowed and repurposed is really satisfying.
Especially if you're cited.
Yes. Make it
Well, so I don't know if you want to retell this story, and I don't actually know the story, but you alluded to it in one of your talks, and it was a story about you being at a conference and asking a question, and you didn't think it was a great question or something. Can you elucidate?
So I think often I notice that students and trainees are scared to ask questions.
Sure.
And the advice that they usually get is, well, you should definitely ask a question because there are no bad questions. But in fact, that is really not true. There are bad questions. And I know because I've asked some bad questions. And it was a talk that I attended many years ago. And I sort of was focused on like one aspect of the talk and kind of like actually missed the point of the talk. And then I asked a question that exposed that my understanding of the talk was totally limited because I was focusing on the wrong thing.
Well, you have to think about how to formulate the question and all of that stuff and get over your nerves of asking it while the talk is going on. So yeah, you might miss some. So
exactly. And I missed something big, but I think probably most people don't remember. Probably 2/3 of the audience wasn't paying close enough attention to know that it was a dumb question because they were zoning out during the talk too, or also focused on the wrong thing. And the remaining third that did notice, I think they've probably forgotten a long time ago that I asked a question. So I say that because I think part of what happens on the path to being able to ask really good questions about a field is asking questions that are not so good and just kind of muddling through the weeds and accepting that early on you don't know a lot about a field. You might get a lot of things wrong, ask things that are trivial, but do it anyway. And that this kind of muddling through is part of a process of moving forward and coming to a really deep understanding of what a field's about.
Oh, so you just described my podcast really well. So thanks for that. Asking the bad questions, you know, muddling through. So so let's talk about some of your recent work here. Okay, so I had John Krakauer on the show, I don't know, many moons ago now. And he, with David Popple and some of their colleagues, wrote this big review that was pretty impactful, I guess, that called for more ethologically valid behavioral experiments and analyses to ensure that the neural data that we're recording and analyzing is actually addressing real processes, right? How things really work in the real world, for instance. And you referenced this paper and wrote a review and introduced and created this three-dimensional coordinate system or framework to better understand where experiments fit within the ethological axis and some other domains. Maybe you can just describe what was the framework that you created and how it's useful.
Yeah, I think we wanted to create the framework because we wanted people to get out of the mindset of thinking of experiments as being ethological versus not ethological. We felt that that was really not a sufficient way to describe what an experiment really was. And part of the reason that we were critical is that we felt that there could sometimes be experimental setups that seemed at first to be ethological, but we felt that wasn't really the right word to describe them. So here's an example. Suppose you're interested in studying the auditory cortex. And so for your most of your career, you've been playing tones and ripples and the sort of things that people use to drive auditory cortical neurons. You're measuring neurons and so on. And then you decide one day, well, you know, I'd like to be more ethological. So I'm going to play, the calls of other conspecifics of this animal.
Right.
And of course, that's a reasonable thing to do. It'd be really nice to know what these neurons do in response to those. But at the same time, it would be a mistake, I think, in my mind, to call that an ethological experiment because we don't really know what's happening from the point of view of the animal. Right? Like suppose that let's take the animal's point of view for a moment. It's there in this kind of box all by itself. There aren't any other of its, conspecifics around it. It's alone. It can't see any other animals. It can't smell any other animals. And all of a sudden it hears this call out of nowhere. It's like, imagine yourself being in kind of a box with nowhere else around. And all of a sudden a voice comes over the speaker. There's a sense in which that's interesting, right? It's an interesting auditory stimulus. We want to know what the brain does. There's also a sense in which that's a serious conflict stimulus. You have one sensory modality that's telling you, oh, one of your brothers is nearby, and every other sensory modality is telling you you're alone. That could be really confusing. It could give rise to responses that reflect the fact that almost never happens in real life, that you get the single modality by itself without anything else. So although I think that's a good experiment, I think it should be done, I think it's a mistake to call that an ethological experiment. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see people get a free pass because they borrow kind of one feature from the animal's natural environment and leave the rest of them out. And honestly, all of us are a long way from measuring neural activity in animals going about their business in their normal environment. Yeah. We're all a long way from that. And to borrow one tiny piece of that and to be, glorified as a result, that, seems to me that that's taking things too far. So we thought, well, okay, let's let go of this idea of ethological versus not ethological, and instead think of kind of a richer framework to describe behavior. So we had these three axes. So one of them was kind of stimulus response compatibility, how much aligned are the response you want the animal to make versus what it would make normally. The ethological validity of the stimuli, where they stimulate the animal would encounter in its normal environment, and then task complexity. And we said, you know, rather than ask than sort of ethological good, not ethological bad, let's just sort of think of experiments as existing somewhere in this framework. So just to be really concrete, like on the one hand, the more natural response, if I have a target appear on the right, would be to look at that target. That would be aligned stimulus response compatible, as I think we called it. But at the same time, the opposite situation where there's a target on the right that you look on the left, that's a really interesting experimental setup, because you have to call in prefrontal mechanisms to suppress the dominant response, do something different. And animals often have to call in those prefrontal mechanisms. So that's a really interesting experiment too. So we hope to kind of push the field to think about behavior in a different way.
So, I mean, I know that John got a lot of pushback on that review that called for more behavior and more careful analyses of behavior. I mean, I can only imagine support for such a nice little framework to think about experiments. Have you gotten any pushback, or what's been the reaction?
You know, I think the reaction from the community was positive, and I think people were open to the idea that they should think about these things in a more complex way. But at the same time, I feel like people need to take into account the trade-offs a little more seriously. I think there are big advantages to using ethological stimuli, the things people would call ethological stimuli, in naive, untrained animals. They speed up training time. They give you a peek into neural circuitry for animals that haven't been trained up on a task. But they also come at a big cost, right? You get many fewer trial counts for animals that aren't trained. You have a lot less control over parameters that might matter for interpreting the data. So I really think the field needs that. We need to include both approaches in our field at the moment. I think that some of the most informative ethological paradigms, I think, are not ones that are trying to kind of push perceptual psychophysics in the ethological domain, but are studying kind of truly ethological behaviors, things like pup calls, for example, and pup retrieval, parental behavior, I think is a really nice example. There's a lot of people doing great work in that area, Katrine Dulac, Rob Tromke, Stephen Shea, my colleague at Cold Spring Harbor. And I think that's an example of a really a behavior that really lends itself well and is just at the right time for systems neuroscience. So I don't want to come down too hard on ethological behavior. I just think we need to ask ourselves carefully what counts as ethological and what the trade-off is each time.
Okay, well, so two of your recent findings, one of which you've already described somewhat at length, actually, but right now they're sitting in BioArchive, and I don't know where they are in the publishing queue or whatever, but I want to talk about them a little bit, and with respect to how they relate to our desire to create artificial general intelligence. Because I think it's an interesting sort of way to approach it. So, like you said before, you found in rodents performing auditory and visual discrimination tasks, decision-making tasks, and looking at whole brain activity, like you described, I guess through the skull, and like you'll talk about at CCN, that the activity was dominated by fidgets and twitches and movement.
Yeah, so just as you said, we were really surprised to find that although the cognitive signals we were interested in did modulate neural activity, the biggest driver of neural activity was the movements that the animal made. And some of them were very much related to the task. They were either movements that we trained the animal to make to report decisions. We call those instructed movements. Or else they were movements that we didn't instruct them to make, but they were related to those instructed movements. Yeah. And some of them were just idiosyncratic fidgets that just occurred at different times on every decision and seemed to reflect something, some priority of the animal that was unknown to us. And overall, taken together, the animals are clearly exploring this really rich movement landscape, even when they're engaged in expert decision making.
Is it an exploration of the movement landscape, or is it just background activity that comes along with the decision making process? Like, how should we think about these things?
It's both. Yeah. So we distinguish the movements into ones that we call task aligned and ones that we call task independent. So task-aligned are movements that we never taught the animal to do, but that happen at stereotype moments in the trial. So you can imagine a couple of examples. So if it's time to harvest the reward, naturally there'd be a licking movement, but there might also be kind of a hind limb movement as the animal pushes forward to sort of, you know, maybe move itself closer in some way to the spout. Or similarly, when the visual stimulus comes on, perhaps the animals always start whisking because they become more engaged or they're anticipating a reward. So those are what we call task-aligned movements. Then you might think of that as being similar to like a baseball player who has to go through a stereotyped set of movements before hitting the ball with the bat. In that they're task-aligned in that they have to occur right before the bat, and they happen at the same order every time the person comes up to bat. And then there are other ones that are idiosyncratic, task independent. And those are things that don't seem to have to, anything to do with the events in the task, but are more like fidgets. And so the human example of that would be, you know, maybe somebody who likes to shake their leg when they're sitting in a seminar, listen to the speaker, who likes to click a pen back and forth, things like that. Movements that aren't obviously related to the task at hand, and yet the decision maker engages in nevertheless.
Yes, the classic baseball player spitting and doing all the grabbing various parts of their bodies as they approach the plate, for instance, things like that.
Yeah, often in a very stereotyped order and at a very stereotyped time.
Okay, so let's keep that in mind, that big sort of big picture, and let's talk about lapses for a second. So this is the other paper that I wanted to bring up called Lapses in Perceptual Decisions Reflect Exploration. So there's this ubiquitous finding in animal experiments that no matter how easy a decision seems, the animal often will make incorrect decisions on those easiest trials at some pretty standardized rate, right? And so there's a known trade-off in decision-making between exploiting what we know and exploring other options, exploitation, exploration. And your claim in the paper is that making incorrect decisions fairly frequently on the easiest trials when it's obvious, the answer is obvious, may reflect an ingrained drive to explore options. And maybe could you just summarize what you found in the study?
Yeah, so we had known about lapses in perceptual decision making for a long time. And a really central assumption of perceptual decision making is that the animal or human knows the rules and rewards of the game. So it knows, you know, this class of stimulus means go to the right and this class of stimulus means go to the left. But the uncertainty comes from the stimulus itself. That is, you might make a stimulus difficult for an animal to discern, as we did in that study.
Right.
And so given that framework, it was very mysterious that animals made mistakes at these very, very easy stimuli. After all, they obviously knew which category it was in. Why on earth would they go to the other one?
Yeah.
And people had a number of explanations for these for quite a long time that were kind of post hoc. And they also, lapses were kind of an... well, this will seem surprising, but they were kind of an emotional issue. People used them kind of as a way to rank animals. They'd say, oh, well, you know, you can't study this in a rat. You know, they make lapses. And the only way to prove them wrong was to get rid of the lapses. They were kind of this, you know, embarrassment. What could you do? Your animal had a lapse. But nobody really tried to understand them or ask why they were there. And so we realized that the current explanations didn't really make sense. I won't go into too much detail about how we were able to rule them out, but yeah. The existing explanations for lapse didn't make sense at all. But partly because we studied them in a multi-sensory framework, which hadn't really been done before, and it immediately exposed that the traditional explanations were wrong. So we realized that perhaps perceptual decision-making was not really so different from value-based decision-making after all. So in value-based decision-making, you have the opposite assumption that all of the stimuli, you know what they are, but you're confused about the rules and rewards of the game. So we said, well, maybe just like, you know, a gambler trying to figure out which arm is going to be more rewarding, maybe the animal and humans, they don't have full knowledge of the stimulus response contingency. And so they sometimes will explore to see if they have misunderstood the nature of the game or perhaps if the game has changed.
Right.
So we built that idea into the model, into an ideal observer model, assuming that subjects wouldn't just explore at random, but they would explore based on how much uncertainty they had about that particular stimulus condition. And using that new model, we were able to account for lapses in really, really diverse experimental conditions and also find evidence of particular neural structures that were involved.
I only make perfect decisions, so this isn't about me, but...
But your friend.
Yeah, my friend makes some poor decisions here and there. Thanks for that. Do you think that we have this built-in mechanism that we just can't override when we're faced with, you know, these really easy decisions, for instance? So do we have this built-in mechanism to ensure that we make poor decisions occasionally?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it ensure that we make poor decisions occasionally. It's more that we're exploring to see whether we really have the right rule about how to do things. Right? I mean, that's what's happening with the animals. They're sort of sure that if the stimulus is in one category, they should do one thing. And if it's the other category, they should do the other. But they're not totally sure. And if you're not totally sure, or if you think maybe the environment is changing, right? It used to be, you know, you should do this. Now it's that you should do that. Then you should explore. So it's not so much that they deliberately made bad decisions, but they strategically made decisions that allowed them to understand more about the nature of the rules of the game.
I mean, do you think this is a possible underlying mechanism for something like creativity or learning in the brain?
I think it is, yeah. And I think very much along those lines, children tend to make more lapses even in perceptual tasks, probably because they're more exploratory. And that is, you're totally right. Part of what you do in the creative process is to do something that at first seems kind of strange or bizarre, but that occasionally provides a totally new way of looking at things.
So, okay, let's talk machines for a second, because I was on a run and I was thinking about these issues and I was thinking you wouldn't want a machine to explore when there's a specific goal. It's a task, right? And where it needs to have some incoming sensory information and make a decision based on that information. And for very easy choices, right? Like it's very green or very red or something. You don't want a machine to make a mistake. But then I thought, well, maybe you do if it's an underlying creativity. What you might want a line of machines, one of which to explore a little bit. And then if it's the answer was wrong, it gets passed to another machine or something, and then you can analyze, well, why is it wrong? Why did it make that mistake? You know, things of that nature. But similarly, I don't think that you'd want a machine's computational resources to be taken up with fidgeting, for instance, right? You could think of these things as sort of taxing the computational resources of a machine or an animal in making a decision. Why is it shrugging its shoulders when it doesn't need to? Things of that nature. I'm just wondering if you have like a, you know, to what extent do we want an AI agent, for instance, to have lapses and to fidget?
We definitely want machines to make lapses. and the reason is that many kinds of machines are going to be existing in environments that are dynamic, right? So let's say you want some kind of machine to distinguish, you know, I don't know, deer versus burglars or something. And, you know, you train it up. You know, you're starting, it was your New Year's resolution to get it going. You train it up in January. It gets really good at distinguishing deer versus burglars. But then come May or June, all the snow melts and all of a sudden the visual inputs that that machine is getting are totally different. Mm-hmm. And so anytime the environment is dynamic, you sometimes need to explore whether the rules have changed, because a rule that worked in one environment might not work in another environment.
Animals will do this even when the environment is not dynamic, right? I mean, I've experienced this frustration myself in the lab.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I think there's two possible explanations for that. And the first one is that they may misperceive the environment as being dynamic. So let's be concrete here. Let's suppose you give an animal a difficult stimulus that's just a weak evidence for category A.
Yeah.
But it because of noise inherent to its brain and so on, it interpreted that it was in category B. It really thought it was in category B. It guessed category B and didn't get a reward. So the animal might think, well, wait a second. I perceived category B. I went to category B. I didn't get anything. Maybe I'm wrong about the rules. So that probably really does happen early in training. So the animals may misperceive an environment as dynamic. But even in a really well-trained animal, if you train an animal for a year, they're not really going to lapse anymore. But for intermediate timeframes, if they haven't been training for very long, it may be that a natural assumption of the brain is that environments are often dynamic. And until you have a lot of evidence to the contrary, you should keep exploring them. And that's true of many kinds of rewarding things. Like if we're talking about food availability, water availability, those things are changing all the time. They're super dynamic. Mm-hmm. And so you should assume that your ability to get harvest or reward from this patch or from this place where your prey likes to hang out, that's going to change.
Yeah.
So that would be sort of a built-in prior that might have developed over many, many millions of years of evolution.
Do we want our AGIs to fidget?
Yeah, so I think that highlights a really big difference between brains and machines, which is that ultimately brains evolved to move the body around. Mm. And possibly a lot of the more sophisticated cognitive processes that we now use are really piggybacking on neural machinery that originally evolved for movement.
Right.
And in machines, that's just really different. There is no plant, as we call it. There's no plant to move around. So it might be that machines would sort of settle on different kinds of solutions because they weren't constrained to repurpose algorithms that were originally evolved, that originally evolved to do something quite different.
Yeah.
And that might be something that's interesting to see, right? Like maybe we could see kind of a signature of borrowing movement circuits in decision-making processes, whereas we might not see that in a machine because those decision circuits in the machine, the in silico ones, they emerge de novo without a plant to move around.
So, I mean, some people think that when we make AI complex enough, that consciousness will emerge, like the word you just used. Other people think that we need to build consciousness into AI for them to be for an AI agent to be conscious, or that consciousness is a necessary precondition for general intelligence like we have. To this point, you know, are these lapses and fidgets and things like that, are they something to build into the AI, or is it something that will kind of fall out because it's built on top of these other algorithms and mechanisms that once we get these algorithms right, will that sort of behavior, lapse, fidgets, things like that, will that sort of fall out based on the computational principles that we engineer into the system?
Yes. So I think the answer for those two different scenarios is quite different. The lapses will for sure fall out.
Yeah.
So anytime, I mean, you want a machine to have an exploration-exploitation trade-off. And anytime you have that, you're going to have exploratory decisions. And if you have stimuli that vary continuously in your stimulus strength, then some of those exploratory decisions will happen to occur on high stimulus strength conditions, and those will be lapses. So that will naturally fall out of most architectures that you could design. Fidgeting, probably not, because I think, and this is my hypothesis, right? But my hypothesis is that the fidgets are present because the way that the brain engages in cognition is by borrowing circuits that originally evolved for movement. And I think sometimes as adults, we're able to get away from that. Not everybody fidgets, right? Some people, when they're deep in thought, don't fidget. They really are stationary. But most people do, and most people move when they're thinking and have a hard time not moving when they're thinking. So I think in humans, movement and cognition may be really tightly linked in a way that they wouldn't have to be in a machine.
Oh, I like that take on it. What's on the horizon in your lab? What's new that you're doing right now?
Yeah, so we're building on the approach that we developed in the wide field setup. So our ability to look at neurons all across the brain, we're now doing that in a much more targeted way where we can look at populations of neurons specifically. So we're really getting kind of the first glimpse into how brainwide populations of specific circuits are engaged during decision making. And we're finding that not all cell types are alike. We see really different responses when we image neural activity in one cell type versus another.
Oh, cool.
That's all I'm going to say for now, because exciting new work. We also would really like to dig deeper on the lapses. So in the work that you and I discussed today, we learned, in addition to having what we think is a much better model for accounting for them, we also learned a little bit about the neural structures that are involved. So we know which structures are involved, but we don't know how they're involved. We don't know what they're doing to help the animal assess the value, estimate the uncertainty, and then decide accordingly. So we'd like to really go into some of those areas and measure the activity of individual neurons to find out how they're supporting the animal's rather strategic tendency to sometimes explore and sometimes exploit.
Yeah, we've got so much going on. It's exciting. It's exciting times. Wes.
Yeah?
Now that my podcast has songs on it, do you still think it's boring?
No.
Oh. Just because the songs?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
You should make the whole podcast a song.
Thank you. So I would like to speak with you about Anne's list. But first, I owe you an apology. Sorry, Anne. You gracefully declined a previous invitation that I gave to you to interview on the show. And I'm not even sure. I don't think you'd be talking with me if it weren't for my involvement with the conference, the CCN conference coming up. So I'm sorry that we're talking. But great job saying no. You used one of the effective methods of saying no when I previously invited you, that you were too busy, but then you pointed me to someone else to invite. But I think that saying no is an underutilized and underappreciated skill, especially when you're busy. Obviously, you're busy, and you can do it more easily as a PI. You think saying no is important, and if so, what advice do you give for like graduate students, let's say, and all of us, when it's right to say no? And how to say no more often than we do.
Yeah, it's always hard to say no. I wish there were more hours in the day because there are many opportunities that I would love to exploit that unfortunately I'm not able to.
Sure.
I think my advice for people who are trying to figure out which opportunities to accept or decline, I think you should accept things that are either really strategic in terms of being in line with your long-term professional goals or things that you really love. People often don't do that. So you might have an opportunity to do X, whatever X is. Think about what your long-term goal is and ask yourself whether that particular opportunity is in line with your long-term goal. And sometimes you have many, many opportunities to choose from. You have to select among them. It's hard to do that.
Yeah.
And people should not be scared to ask for advice. It is not always obvious what is the best thing to do to support your future career goals, whatever they are. But I think in addition to that, you should accept some things just because you really love doing them, because they're really fun. I do a certain amount of community service going into elementary schools and showing kids' brains and showing them how to, you know, cut them up and see what's inside and telling them why I love science. And I do that partly because I think it's a good thing to do, but I think it's really fun and really rewarding. Sometimes we think, well, you know, I shouldn't take the time to do community service because it's not in term with my, you know, long-term goals. But if it's something that you love and something that's going to make you happy, you should totally do it. And it's a great way to give back. If you don't love it, if you find it tiresome, you know, skip it and do something else. But I think we should allow ourselves to do things that are good for the field overall because it brings us happiness and joy. And we should take the time to do that. And it's a great thing to do for the community.
Is that how you convince your students to never say no to your requests?
I think they do say no.
Oh, good. Good for them. Okay. You've trained them well then. So,
yeah.
So the way that this is related to Anne's list, I know it seemed like a long shot there, but one of the reasons that you may have said no to me was this effect that's known as the Matthew effect, which is the principle that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You know, you could say it another way, that success makes further success easier. And you see this in academia. You see it in citations, the way that people, you know, the same people get cited over and over and over, in speaker invitations, in publications, and so on. So women in academia. So Anne's list is a list that you started personally and then ended up making it available online. Is it annslist.org?
.net.
Yeah. Well, I'll link to it also, annslist.net. So the way I understand it, there are sort of two problems. One, that there's a lack of women represented in conferences and academia in general and speaking engagements. And the second related problem is that because there are fewer women in general, the same women get invited over and over as speakers. You are one of those women. So I bring up the Matthew effect because those women, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, those same women get invited over and over. This also happens to be the case with men because the same men get invited over and over. But there's a difference. So what's the difference between the phenomena between men and women?
No, I think there is a difference. I think it's the same thing, right?
Tell me a bit more about Anne's list and just how it's going, you know, how what effect it's had.
Well, first, I should say that actually a few years ago, the person who's maintaining and running the list, it was taken over by Jenny Brown, who's a postdoc at Berkeley. So I should give her credit for doing a great job. She had also a lot of nice features and improvements to the list. But yeah, I think in general, it's going really well. I think one thing that might be confusing is people sometimes think that I started the list because I was sad that I didn't get enough conference invitations. But in fact, that's not the case. I have always had lots of speaker invitations. I've been really very lucky and very fortunate to have many opportunities to give seminars and so on. But I started the list for a different reason, which is I think that in science, when we are making decisions about, for instance, who to invite to a talk, we aren't going to make great decisions if we are excluding particular groups within our population. And women are not only underrepresented, but are invited disproportionately to their numbers, to conferences and so on. And especially when I started the list, there were lots of conferences that were all male conferences, panels that were all male panels. And so I started the list not because I was hoping to get more speaker invitations myself, but because I think the scientific community will be better overall if we extend our invitation list to include a broader number of people. And just to put it another way, if you see a conference, you know, that has 25 people and, you know, 19 of them are guys, it's sort of like it tips you off that maybe the conference organizers didn't put that much time into thinking who they were going to invite. And maybe they just thought of who their pals in graduate school were and the people they've been collaborating with, which I guess isn't a terrible thing to do, but it's probably not going to be a top-notch conference if that was their speaker selection procedure. And the conferences that are really good, they will tend to look more broadly and think, well, who's really up and coming in this field? What's some new work that suddenly has become part of this field that wasn't before? And I wanted to have the list to give people an opportunity to consider speakers that they weren't otherwise considering. I should say that in the process of doing this, I realized that if my goal was really to make science more accessible to all people and to promote the work of a broader group of scientists, then there's a sense in which it isn't really right to just restrict this to female scientists.
Sure.
There are other groups of scientists that are underrepresented in the field, people from underrepresented groups, ethnic minorities, racial minorities, people with disabilities. And I think that these are part of a very similar problem. And as scientists, we need to be better at representing all of these groups more. I started Anne's List because I'm a woman myself and I felt comfortable doing it. But my overall vision for science is that we will be more open and more welcoming to all people. And that the problem of women being underrepresented is really a symptom of a much greater problem of people not selecting speakers, not organizing conferences in sort of a thoughtful and scientifically rigorous enough way.
Yeah, this is, I mean, somewhat related. I was really disappointed in realizing how political academia still is. You wouldn't think that. And so you'd think that we'd all be unbiased, apolitical in terms of jockeying for position and inviting our friends, and papers get accepted or declined based on that still. And it's, you know, you'd think that wouldn't be present in science. So, but it sure is still.
Yeah, it really is. And I think actually all of these problems are really symptomatic of an even more general problem, which is that I think right now science is very hierarchical and very kind of in-groupy. So for instance, if you can think of a conference that sort of seems to be run by an in-group thing, kind of a group of people, kind of really cliquey, first of all, it's probably the case that there aren't too many women at that field. But it might be informative to ask the men who are submitting abstracts and submitting posters, do they think it's fair? Mm. You know, is it a small group of people that are kind of setting up an organization or a conference that benefits a small number of people? Because often if you look at an organization and find that the women aren't really represented, don't have a voice in that organization, it often is the case that there's a lot of men that don't have a voice in that organization either, because all of the power is kind of concentrated to a small number of people who aren't really thinking about the good of the organization or the good of the field. And so my hope is really that these kinds of changes will make fields and will make conferences better for all people.
Well, I know that on the woman front, there's a lot of active voices out there. I hear them on Twitter. I'll be interviewing some more people who are very active and vocal in doing these things. So nice job. Mm-hmm. It's bringing this to people's attention. So I think that's a very positive thing. So what do you think is something that is important that neuroscience will contribute to artificial intelligence moving forward?
Yeah, well, I think biological networks still have some advantages over artificial networks in terms of how quickly they learn, how many samples they need, how flexible they are. The networks that we have today are really powerful in a lot of ways, but they aren't as good as humans in a lot of kinds of tasks. So I think if we understand how human brains implement these computations, then I think we'll be in a position to make even better artificial networks.
What's something that you think that AI should be paying more attention to in neuroscience?
I think it might be beneficial to look at what's happening during structure learning. So to ask how is the behavior and how are the neural responses in animals changing as animals are learning the structure of a complex environment? Mm. We're only just starting to understand that because we don't have too many instances where animals are really exploring a complex environment and learning it. But I think understanding how the neural activity changes might be really informative and might kind of give hints as to how animals are sometimes able to efficiently, other times not efficiently, figure out the structure of an environment, especially a dynamic one, and then exploit that.
Yeah, that's good. Is there any sort of historical idea that is not in the mainstream these days, or body of work, you know, that you think that neuroscience or the AI community should be paying more attention to that doesn't get enough attention these days?
I think developmental and cognitive psychology are really, really interesting fields. There's a ton of absolutely fascinating work that details how humans go from being infants that know nothing about the world and nothing about their bodies to eventually becoming adults that are skilled in moving their bodies around and understanding the world, and kind of looking at how the built-in circuits, and infants have a lot of them for understanding the world. They come into the world with fairly sophisticated mathematical knowledge, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
Innate circuits interact with the kinds of stimuli that they're exposed to really shape their cognitive abilities. And there's just a treasure trove of really interesting work in really young children all the way up through school-age children, kind of documenting how that happens and the kinds of errors that babies make and don't make. And I think it tells us a lot about the neural basis of these higher cognitive functions as the developing human both learns about the world and also has a brain that becomes very different as time goes by, as the brain itself develops, becomes more myelinated, grows prefrontal cortex, and so on.
I can tell you have developing children. What is a special talent that you have that not many people know about?
I really love to cook.
Oh, okay.
I love to cook. And my favorite style of cooking is to just have a whole bunch of stuff, ingredients, and just to figure out something to do on the fly and to make something delicious and then to eat it outside with a bunch of friends.
All right. I'll be over at 9. What is something, what's something that you used to believe that you consider naive now?
Oh, God, I need a minute to think. I think I used to believe that it would be easy for people to come together and work collectively on big problems. And now I realize that it's essential that we come together and work collectively on big problems, but that it isn't easy to do that. And that all of us, when we engage in a big team effort, we have to have a major change of mindset and an ability to listen to new ideas and an ability to sometimes let our own ideas go. That's really challenging. And I think I've experienced that kind of in my own life, teaming up with other people to work on big problems. And it's really the way to go. It's really effective and it really works. But I think all of us need to become more skilled in how to do that effectively.
Well, I will let you go now. I appreciate your time. I know you have things to attend to, but thanks very much for being with me, Anne. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much. Great speaking with you.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time.